Deadline: Beijing accuses Washington of paranoid delusion after the U.S. Senate passed a bill aimed at countering what it calls the surging economic threat from China. London addressed flexibility from Brussels over trading arrangements in Northern Ireland as the UK and the European Union prepare for key talks on implementing the Brexit deal. And also, the mayor of the Canadian city of London, where four members of a Muslim family were killed, condemns the bloodshed as an act of hatred and Islamophobia. Our top story for this half hour: China has strongly condemned the U.S. for approving a bill aimed at countering what Washington sees as a Chinese technology threat. In a statement, China's parliament accuses the U.S. of, quote, paranoid delusion. It said the bill smeared China's domestic and foreign policies and interfered in its internal affairs. On Tuesday, the U.S. Senate approved a sweeping industrial policy bill to boost the country's ability to compete with Chinese technology. The bill would authorize about $190 billion for provisions to strengthen U.S. technology and research. The bill must now pass the House of Representatives to be sent to the White House for President Joe Biden to sign it into law. Political commentator Kindo Zhu says the United States uses anti-China policies to overcome its domestic issues.
Some of the steps are justified, unnecessary probably, from the U.S. point of view to compete with China. For example, more investment, industrial policy. Secondly, you can see what is the problem with the bill is, like, basically you can call it like an anti-China bill. First of all, it terms China's development as a threat to the United States. I'm not sure that's proper for any country to call another country's development is a threat. The Chinese people, just like the Iranian people, just like American people, they have a right to better living standard, to development, and to high technology, the command of high technology. So the U.S. does not have this monopoly. The U.S. Somehow thinks that they are the only country which is suitable to lead the world, which is suitable to lead the world in terms of technology, in terms of innovation. I think there's a lot of hubris to think that way. And I think the Chinese people are entitled to have a better life, are entitled to enjoy this innovation and to do a lot of investment, develop their technology and science. The U.S. basically is using China as an excuse to achieve a unity, because this country is severely divided.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says hundreds of sanctions against Iran could remain in place even if the 2015 nuclear deal is revived.
I would anticipate that even in the event of a return to compliance with the JCPOA, hundreds of sanctions would remain in place, including sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. If they are not inconsistent with the JCPOA, they will remain unless and until Iran's behavior changes. Our responsibility would be to put sanctions in.
Blinken was addressing a Senate committee meeting on the recent talks in Vienna on the revival of the nuclear deal. He said, at this stage, the U.S. does not know whether Iran is willing to do what's needed to come back into compliance. The United States withdrew from the international court in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran began rolling back its nuclear commitments. Tehran and the reigning parties are now engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the agreement. Tehran has time and again said it will return to compliance only after the U.S. removes all sanctions verifiably. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the U.S. Approach toward the nuclear deal revival effort shows its lack of determination to return to the accord.
I think Mr. Blinken has clarified two things. One is that the JCPOA discussions are not really to do with Iran's nuclear industry. It's all about trying to sideline Iran's influence in the region. Iran, having the high moral ground, doesn't really need to do anything. It says it's waiting on the U.S. to come back to compliance in a practical sense. And on the other hand, the U.S. perhaps is trying to provoke Iran to move away from it and therefore gain some kudos, perhaps with the Europeans, but really it seems to be going nowhere.
Iran's foreign minister says his country is ready to facilitate peace talks in Yemen and Afghanistan to promote regional peace and stability. Mohammad Javad Zarif says he has made the comment during separate meetings in Tehran with UN special envoys to Yemen and Afghanistan. The top Iranian diplomat described as fruitful his talks with Martin Griffiths on Yemen and Jean Arnois on Afghanistan. Zarif told them that peace processes must be owned by all Yemenis and Afghans without what he called external imposition. The UN is trying to bring warring sides in Yemen to the negotiating table to end a Saudi-led conflict which started in 2015. In Afghanistan, the government is in talks with the Taliban militant group to hammer out a peace deal after years of bloody violence. A delegation from Oman is in the Yemeni capital as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. The delegation has held talks with leader of Yemen's Ansar movement, Abdel Malik El-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Abdel Latif El-Washani Azmour from Sana'a.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine. Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first real step toward a nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
A Bahraini political prisoner has died from COVID-19 after he was denied medical care. Hossein Barakat was in a coma due to severe lung infection and lack of oxygen. His health conditions deteriorated as the Bahraini Interior Ministry and prison officials refused to release him temporarily. Bahraini officials kept the family of Barakat unaware of his health condition. Some 220 political prisoners in Bahraini jails have been infected by COVID since the pandemic began. Activists say those inmates face medical negligence. That is seen as part of widespread discrimination against the country's Shia majority by the ruling Al Khalifa regime. The UK and the European Union are engaged in negotiations on how to implement their agreement on the country's departure from the bloc. They're at odds over post-Brexit rules in Northern Ireland, with both sides calling on each other to compromise. We were joined by our London and Brussels correspondents to get more on the story. On this edition of the program, Britain and the European Union are set to hold key talks on how to implement their agreement on the country's divorce from the bloc. The meeting in London will cover trading arrangements with a focus on Northern Ireland. Among other issues, Britain is demanding flexibility from Brussels over the province. It says that it wants the bloc to engage with proposals to overcome challenges. The EU is angry at the UK over what it sees as unilateral actions overriding the so-called protocol of the withdrawal deal covering Northern Ireland. Britain officially left the EU in January 2020. The two sides have been trading on new terms since then, but Northern Ireland remains an unresolved issue in post-Brexit relations. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have Ahmed Caballo, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Jerome, one would have thought, you know, to ourselves, we were thinking that by June 2021, EU and Britain would have figured this whole Brexit deal out. It seems that that's still not the case. What are some of the impediments that the two sides are facing right now?
That's right, Bardi. Well, the reason it's sort of coming now again to another crunch time, and they always seem to leave these deadlines, you know, just the negotiations right up to the deadline, is because the crux of the protocol agreement, the key elements were not implemented. There was a sort of a six-month grace period, and that grace period runs out at the end of this month. So now they have to find agreement. But I have to say, speaking to senior officials here in Brussels, there is such a lack of trust towards Boris Johnson and his government. They really do not trust them as negotiating partners. And it's the same for the unionists in Northern Ireland. Half the population are unionists. They're pro-British, but they really do not trust Boris Johnson. You remember Theresa May had a big deal here, and they were going to sign off on it in Brussels. And then the unionist says not a chance, because the deal differentiates Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, and they consider themselves British. And the deal collapsed because at the time Theresa May's government was being propped up in the House of Commons by a number of DUP, you know, unionist politicians. Then Boris Johnson took over from Theresa May, called a general election. He got a big majority in the House of Commons, so he can effectively do what he likes. And then he put into place this protocol deal, which the unionists absolutely hate. And, you know, they say, actually, it's kind of flowery language to say that there's a border on the Irish Sea to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland to try and preserve the Belfast Peace Agreement, because effectively that border is a hard border running along the east coast of Northern Ireland. So it's effectively a border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, because when we have you know, meat products, dairy products coming in from the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland, they're going to be checked on the border. And for this, the unionists, it's just not good enough. They say that we're part of the UK, we're British, and so on. And we're actually coming up to the marching season now in Northern Ireland. And this is where the unionists parade across Northern Ireland to sort of demonstrate how British they are. And really, there's a lot of concern that if a serious deal cannot be reached, then we could have serious violence. I mean, there's always violence. It has decreased over the years during the marching season. There is concern now that we could have renewed violence, intensified violence in Northern Ireland. And I think Boris Johnson is thinking that, you know, because the EU will want to save face and want to prevent violence, that it will back down and it will become more flexible in terms of the negotiations. But there's another element to it, and that is that Joe Biden has made it clear that he's very much behind the EU on this issue and very much behind the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement. And so that actually might apply pressure on Boris Johnson's government, because Boris Johnson's government wants a trade deal with the United States. So it's very much up in the air, and we just have to wait and see how it pans out. But if they don't get an agreement, when we have this marching season coming up, we really could see problems.
Ahmed, in London, I'd like to get your perspective on the issue as well. As Jerome mentioned, there's a lot of distrust right now towards the government of Boris Johnson.
Yes, I mean, there was signs that this was going to be a problem from the get-go. But Boris Johnson was so determined to, quote-unquote, get Brexit done, that he implemented the Northern Ireland Protocol, knowing that it was going to upset the unionists, knowing that it was going to have a potential for violence. So he tried to implement it, and he tried to implement it strictly on goods. So there are no checks on people and surfaces, thinking that that would kind of soften the blow. But it hasn't softened the blow. There's been tensions in Belfast, tensions in Derry, tensions throughout what they call Northern Ireland. And those tensions will escalate because, like my colleague said, the people of the unionists in Northern Ireland do not want to see a distinction between themselves and the people of Britain. And they see that their rights, their concerns have been put on the kind of back burner to the concerns of the Irish nationalists, who do not want to see a hard border between the north of Ireland and the south of Ireland. And that is what's causing the kind of violence on the streets. And my colleague is right that we haven't really seen anything yet. The violence that's happened so far hasn't even happened in the summer months. When we start to see the so-called orange marches and the marches that happen through Catholic areas of the north of Ireland by unionists. That's when we're going to see this kind of tinderbox really explode.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Dahmat Kawalo joining us from London. Also, thanks to Jerome Hughes speaking to us from Brussels. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Elsewhere, mourners have held a vigil in Canada to remember four members of a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack on Sunday. The event was held in the capital, Ottawa, in East Central Ontario province. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in attendance, too. He expressed sorrow over the tragic incident and said, "The thoughts and prayers of all Canadians are with the victims." Trudeau said his government would take action, but gave no details. Other mourners attending the event expressed grief and described the attack as a horrific crime.
I want every single one of us, from the highest levels of government, from our elected officials, to the everyday commoner that exists in our country, in our province, in our city, in our community, to make a commitment, a solemn promise, that you will do everything within your capacity to fight the scourge of racism, of discrimination, of xenophobia, in any form that it exists.
The mayor of London in Ontario province, where the crime happened, issued a statement on Twitter. Ed Holder called the crime an act of mass murder rooted in unspeakable hatred. He said, "This act of Islamophobia must be followed by acts of compassion." On Sunday, four members of a Muslim family were killed in the Canadian city when a man rammed them with his pickup truck. Police say they were targeted because of their religion. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Israeli regime's detention of a reporter and two prominent Palestinian rights activists in Sheikh Jarrah is drawing international condemnation as residents of the East Al-Quds neighborhood continue to resist a forced expulsion campaign led by the regime-backed Israeli settlers. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, Israeli regime condemned for arrest of journalists and two activists in Sheikh Jarrah. Stay tuned for more. Israeli regime's detention of a reporter and two prominent Palestinian rights activists in Sheikh Jarrah is drawing international condemnation as residents of the East Al-Quds neighborhood continue to resist a forced expulsion campaign led by regime-backed Israeli settlers. On Saturday, June 5th, Israeli regime police assaulted and arrested Al Jazeera journalist Givara Buderi as she covered a sit-in marking the 54th anniversary of the Zionist regime's 1967 occupation of East Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. The police also destroyed Al Jazeera cameraman Nabil Mazawi's equipment. Buderi, who at the time of her arrest was wearing a flak jacket that clearly identified her as a member of the press, was released hours later on the condition that she stay away from Sheikh Jarrah for at least 15 days. Buderi's arrest drew sharp rebukes from global press freedom organizations and Al Jazeera, whose acting director general said in a statement that such attempts to prevent journalists from carrying out their professional duty to inform the world and report events on the ground is a crime against the journalistic profession. The Foreign Press Association said the journalist's arrest represents just the latest in a long line of heavy-handed tactics by Israeli regime police. Hours after Buderi's release, Israeli regime police reportedly stormed into the home of 23-year-old activist Munal Kurd and arrested her, alleging that she participated in public disturbances in Sheikh Jarrah. Munal has since been freed. The police on Sunday, June 6, also arrested Munal's twin brother Muhammad Al-Kurd, who has gained global attention for fiercely defending Palestinian rights during recent appearances on major media programs. The Al-Kurd family is one of many facing possible expulsion. Israel is on a rampage in Sheikh Jarrah, detaining journalists and prominent Palestinians like Al-Kurd twins, all because they won't shut up about being ethnically cleansed from their homes, tweeted journalist Alex Kane. Middle East Eye reported on Sunday, June 6, that the siblings, whose family has been living under the threat of imminent displacement from their house in Karam al-Jouni in occupied East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, have become icons of the Palestinian struggle against Israeli settler expansion, he added. The latest crackdown in Sheikh Jarrah by Israeli regime police came just days before the Supreme Court is set to rule on whether Palestinians in the neighborhood can be expelled from their homes at the behest of Israeli settlers. A hearing on the matter was postponed last month, just before the Zionist regime kicked off its deadly 11-day bombing campaign in the occupied Gaza Strip. The historic Sheikh Jarrah district is inhabited by the descendants of Palestinian refugees who were expelled from their towns and villages by the Zionist militias during the Palestinian Nakba catastrophe of 1948, Middle East Eye noted, adding, at least 13 families have been ordered to leave their homes in Sheikh Jarrah since May, including 58 people facing the threat of expulsion from their homes where they lived for generations. In October 2020, an Israeli court ruled in favor of Israeli settlers who claimed that some 8 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah are living on land that used to belong to Jews. Yusuf Monayer, a Palestinian-American writer and political analyst, said on Sunday, June 6th, that through attacking and arresting journalists and now arresting two of its most outspoken advocates in Muna al-Kurd and Muhammad al-Kurd, the Israeli regime is trying to stop you from hearing about Sheikh Jarrah. Adding, the best response is to listen harder and amplify their voices louder.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam, Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. Dear brothers and sisters, every person's character is hidden behind his tongue and words. Many of our problems in life have root in our word and how we use our tongue. On the other hand, one can develop and grow through his words. This means that we can convey many good points through our tongue or words. Now, in today's world, many societies are afflicted with the sins that are related to tongue and words.
البته وقتی میگم زبان امروز زبان مجازی را منظورم هست.
Of course, by tongue and words, I only do not mean the speaking, but also the sentences and audios and videos that are produced through social media and social networks, whether it is written or spoken. In other words, whenever you're sending a message or voice or video on a social network, you're using your tongue, and you have to be careful about what you write or say. This is because your words on social media can also be afflicted with a slander, backbite, jealousy, and suspicion. And these sins have negative effects on your life and the lives of others. Therefore, the sins of tongue are not just limited to your speaking. It can be your writing in the newspaper, website, social media, and other platforms too. As a result, we have to be very careful about our sayings and writings, because they may lead us to hellfire in this world and the other world. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
inside Israel.
Ashkenazi Israelis include white European settlers both on the left and the right side of politics. This elite group of people have been at a struggle with the other marginalized communities in Israel, including the Mizrahi Eastern and Sephardi Spanish and North African Jews, for decades. Nothing highlights this struggle better than the fight over a small neighborhood in northern Israel named the Nir David Kibbutz. The residents of the neighborhood are upper-class Ashkenazi Israelis. This, while all the other neighborhoods around them are lower-class residents. Now, during the hot summer days, residents from the surrounding areas would like to enjoy the local Asi River to cool off. However, the residents of Nir David Kibbutz won't allow them to do so unless they paid. This goes contrary to Israeli law, which says that rivers in Israel are allowed to be used by all Israelis. Even after the locals took Nir David residents to court and won, they still do not have access to the water. In recent years, a group of non-Ashkenazi residents from communities around the Nir David Kibbutz have been waging a struggle to ensure free public access to the Asi River. They filed a lawsuit against the kibbutz in 2015 that resulted in the Nir David Kibbutz vowing to open access to sections of the river, a promise they never kept. The struggle to free the Asi River has intensified. Israelis are tired of the same status quo. The Nir David Kibbutz and the Asi River highlights the current social disparities and the overwhelming control and perceived favoritism by courts and the Israeli system towards Ashkenazi Israelis. Over the past few months, residents of the surrounding towns, together with activists from across Israel, have been showing up at the Nir David Kibbutz gates every day in an attempt to access the river. They are mostly upset over the Nir David Kibbutz's continued refusal to adhere to the Water Act and allow them to bathe or swim or enjoy summer times on the river during the several heat waves Israel had this summer. In response, they have been met with locked and guarded gates, as well as violence from kibbutz members who attack them with belts and sticks. Earlier in September, the protesters successfully entered the kibbutz and were able to reach and enjoy the river. The day nevertheless ended with violence, as kibbutz members trapped one of the protesters inside the kibbutz gates, kicking him while he lay on the ground, an attack which sent him to the hospital with a concussion and a bruised kidney. Other protesters found their tires slashed.
Actually, the residents of Nir David doesn't allow anybody to enter the kibbutz, even if you offer payment. The only way that you can enter the kibbutz is if you are a member of the kibbutz, or if you have a friend from the kibbutz that let you in, or you are within an organized group that take part of the touristic enterprise, or you are willing to pay $350 for a zimmer or a suite inside the kibbutz. Only that way you can enter. So the main, if you ask me, the main reason for them to refuse entrance of outsiders is they want to preserve the privilege of swimming and enjoying the Asi River for themselves without the entrance of other people to that area. Well, I think that it will be more accurate to describe this struggle as not as a struggle between the next town to the kibbutz. It's a national struggle. A struggle of personal people or small communities that are taking control over nature resources, claiming themselves to their own, and gaining from the usage of those natural resources against the law. I guess the struggle between the different parties is being symbolized by some people in the public as an ethnical struggle between the white Ashkenazis Jews to the Eastern, Middle Eastern, North African Jews. I think there are deeper reasons for that. I think that the struggle is between those with privileges in Israel and not necessarily involve their skin color to those that have no resources and have not been privileged from before.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Free Palestine says the parks are planted on the ruins of Palestinian villages. Boycott these parks, boycott terrorist Israel. Mondo Weiss says Al-Sakhina's lands are now part of the nearby Nir David settlement. No physical evidence remains by which the site may be identified, as the entire area has been plowed and turned into agricultural fields. According to Haaretz says, at issue, at least on the face of it, is whether Kibbutz Nir David has the right to prevent those Israelis who do not live on its grounds from swimming in what is arguably Israel's most beautiful waterway. Joshua says, after years of fighting, Kibbutz Nir David will allow the public to visit the river that runs through it, considered the nicest river in Israel, though they can kiss that goodbye once the masses descend on its aquamarine shores.
Well, they feel superior because the rest of the Israelis came from countries that they were more poor and they were not so well educated. The Jews in Europe, they went to schools and universities, and the other Arab Jews, Sephardic and Mizrahi, they were more people that they didn't know anything about cultural studies, and so they the Zionist state put them together in this state, and of course the Ashkenazic they feel superior, and also because you know that many whites are supremacists, so they feel like a supremacist race against the other Jews, the other target.
This sample of the overall population correctly reflects on the overall privilege received by the white European settlers as opposed to the inequalities, disparities, and racism received by Eastern, Spanish, and North African Jews. The left-wing Ashkenazis enjoy wide support from secularly white Europeans, while the right-wing receives support from non-secularist white European Ashkenazis. Both the left and right received some support from the rest of Israelis, including Mizrahi, Sephardic, North African Jews, and Arabs, who to them are political game and are in demand during voting times, as they represent a large number, and large numbers means more votes. Israeli observers say that this battle proves that the left-wing Zionists in Israel are actually right-wing with a different color. As the subject is a hot topic in Israel, politicians also took part in the discussion. Members of the left-wing Ashkenazi Israelis claim that the river is part of the kibbutz members' home and that entering it amounts to a violent invasion. Yeli Yakubs, a senior Nir David official and board member of the Israeli Women's Network, the Israel's largest leftist national feminist organization, drew a parallel between the protests and sexual assault. One prominent left-wing personality suggested that the Osir River struggle is just not that important, and another jokingly ranked it at number 43 on a list of the 42 critical struggles for the future of Israel. The right-wing, or those loyal to Netanyahu's party who have some support from Mizrahi Jews, argued that allowing free access to the river would destroy it, as public visitors would not keep the river and its banks clean. This is not true at all, as the tourism office of the Nir David kibbutz actually allows visitors from outside the local area to visit, only if they pay. Activists believe that this argument heavily relies on racist stereotypes regarding the hygiene and cleanliness of the surrounding area's Mizrahi residents.
In general, it's true that the immigrants from North Africa or from Eastern or Sephardic countries have been struggling in their early years, and there were there was a problem with sharing or dividing the natural resources or the financial resources between those different communities. Historically speaking, today things are a little bit different, but still there are pockets of racism and pockets of injustice between those communities.
The conversation lasted a while on Twitter. Eno says, "Soon the river of trash and ash. I totally understood why they did not want to open it. They should at least install a system that ensures those who litter can be identified and held accountable." Joshua points out, "Guards at Nir David near Beit Shean chasing away hikers who want to visit the Asi stream, a public waterway which flows through the kibbutz, but which they zealously guard, unless you pay them protection by staying at a guest house there. This is an ongoing fight." Sharuna says, "The Ashkenazim appointed Arabs to guard them from the Mizrahis. Scum." Oz says, "Common denominator, a minority that controls the majority, streams and routes in the areas of the kibbutzim, natural resources of us all, an elite that controls the top, academia, and other clubs close to the masses. Salute and be silent."
Well, what's true about religion, again, is that, all the Jews were religious everywhere in the world until, the 19th century, the later part of the 18th century. And then in the later part of the 18th century into the 19th century, you had in Europe the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was really a movement away from religion, towards science, towards secularism, and you had in the Jewish community Jews leaving the religious world and becoming secular. Some became communists, like Trotsky. Some became socialists, like Ben-Gurion and many of those that founded the State of Israel. Well, you never had the Enlightenment in the Middle East, which is on today a problem. So the Middle East never had a concept of secular. And so Jews, Mizrahi Jews, weren't as orthodox. They weren't as strict as the Ashkenazi Jews had been when they were religious. And they mix much more what we'd call today secular and religious. They're much lighter in their religion, but they're religious. Or we would call them, I guess, traditional might be the best word to call them. They're not super orthodox, but on the other hand, they're not secular either. And I think this is a whole issue in the Muslim world. The entire Muslim world, I think, is wrestling today with this idea, with this problem of enlightenment and secularism and religion. It's a tension, and so it's also a tension between Ashkenazi Jews and Mizrahi Jews.
Near David neighborhood has over the past few months highlighted the struggles in what is seen as a small sample representing the greater fight between Ashkenazi Jews and the other marginalized communities. Near David is predominantly made up of Ashkenazim, Jews of European descent who founded Israel and dominated its resources, as well as its economic, cultural, and military institutions. These neighborhoods house Ashkenazi Jews both in the right and the left. The residents of Nir David do not allow access to the Asi River, and if they do, it will not be free. They have erected fences and barriers to prevent public access to the river. According to the Israeli regime's Water Act, waterways are public property that must remain accessible and open to all. Despite this, the status quo remains the same. In order to change the small sample presented here, the bigger picture needs to come down.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.